Our reading today is from the book of Proverbs, chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. Proverbs, chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance, for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction.
Well, the bags are packed, the car has been loaded, and it's time to go. It's been a moment that's been 18 years in the making. From your child's first cries, the terrible twos, the emotional first day at school, the frustration of the final year exams, the glorious holidays in between. For 18 years, you've known that this day was going to come. You've held their hand through it all. But now, as you turn the key in the engine, it's time to let go. Time to cut the apron strings. Time to let them fly the nest, to chart their own course in life and make of themselves what they will. It's an enormous moment for both parties and brings into sharp clarity the last 18 years of parenting. Do they know how to iron a shirt? Do they know how to manage money? Do they know to wash behind their ears? And what should you have mentioned more? What should you have mentioned less? For the child, it could be the first heady taste of freedom, faced with some fear and trepidation, of course, alongside great excitement as well. What will this new world hold for me? And that's where Proverbs finds us. It's written as a young man is about to strike out into the world. It sits him down and tries to give him a compass to follow, something which is going to light his way in future years. In some ways, Proverbs is a little bit like this book, a book by Bear Grylls, To My Sons, Lessons in the Wild Adventure Called Life. It's the culmination of years of wisdom and experience of life that he's boiled down and wants to give to his sons. It contains wisdom such as speak generously about people. Wisdom such as be open and honest and fair in all your dealings. And there are hundreds of reasons why we could spend time studying the book of Proverbs and have it as part of our daily diet. It could be that you're leaving home this September and you need to have those chats now before it's too late. You might be a parent wondering, what on earth do I teach my children? Or I know, relationships with some parents might be hard or absent or difficult. It could be that life is tough and you need a bit of help. Proverbs is here to guide us. Wonderfully, God doesn't just save us and say, see you in heaven. He really cares for our life as well. He's invested in our life now. He wants to give us the tools to live our life really well. And we're going to spend a while in Proverbs. And today we'll look especially at Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 to 7, which acts almost like the blurb on the back of a book, the bit of a book which tries to get you to buy it and to read it. It tells us who it's from, who it's for, what it's for, and where to begin. So let's look now at who this book of Proverbs is from. Verse 1, it is the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. It's written largely by Solomon. There are, of course, other authors who we'll come to later on in the book, but it's fair to say that most of the book was written by Solomon, and we're given two details about it. Firstly, Solomon was the son of David. That places this book in its context, the context of God's covenant and promises to David. This isn't a book of how we establish a relationship with God. This is a book more on the along the lines of how we live out that relationship with God. And secondly, he was a king in Israel. This is the high point in Israel's history. They're in God's promised land under God's king. The time of immense prosperity and wealth and wisdom. Solomon is the kind of guy who we'd say has brains the size of a planet. We see that when a foreign queen, the queen of Sheba, comes to visit him. She's doubtful at first of his wisdom, but slowly she warms up to him. Hear what she has to say in 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 6 to 8. She says, "The report I heard about you in my own country of your achievement and wisdom is true. But I didn't believe these things until I came and saw them with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth you exceed the report I heard. How happy are your people must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom." How happy are those that get to listen to Solomon's wisdom. You might have come across on YouTube some adverts for masterclasses. World-leading experts offer up their secrets for only £85 for 10 lessons. How happy are those who get to learn to cook the perfect steak with Gordon Ramsay? How happy are those that can learn to sing with Christina Aguilera? But here we have something even more valuable. A world-renowned expert sits down with us to chat about life. Wouldn't that be great to have someone to help us to navigate the minefield of relationships? Someone who can clear a little bit of the fog of consequences, the consequences of our actions. But that's not really the point that this is making. The point isn't that Solomon is our teacher, as wonderful as that is. The point is not that we get to listen to Solomon, but that we get to listen to God. See, the Queen of Sheba, she goes on. She says, "Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel." You'll remember the story of how when Solomon becomes king, God says, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." And Solomon, you'll remember, asks for wisdom. And that's what God gives him in an abundant measure. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. We'll come back to this again as we come through Proverbs. But the value of this book is not that this is Solomon's wisdom, some ancient way of living, but that this is God's wisdom on the world. This is the Maker's instruction manual for life. But we're moving there into our second question. What is this book for? If we look back at verses 2 and 3, it says, "It is for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair." Proverbs is there to give us wisdom. Now, wisdom is a funny term which is quite hard to nail down exactly what it means. You might have heard the famous quote that knowledge is knowing that tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad. And that's getting at something there. Wisdom is connected to the idea of being skillful. In isolation, these past few weeks, maybe you've tried to turn your hand to a bit of DIY, some woodwork. I had a go at a pan rack just this last week, and I wouldn't say that I was at all skilled at it, quite the opposite in fact, but I do know that to cut a bit of wood, you don't use a hammer. To cut a bit of wood, you use a saw. It will go a lot better if you use the right tool for the job. And that is wisdom. A wise craftsman knows which tool to use to get the best result. And Solomon's trying to give us that sort of wisdom, that sort of skill, not in cabinet making, but skill in life. And the list of topics that he tackles is huge. From work to wealth, sleep to speech, friends to family, food to fun, health to happiness. Now, this isn't just a theoretical textbook that doesn't really make a difference to our daily life. This is a book with practical exercises in it. It's for receiving instruction in prudent behaviour. It's not really been understood if it's not been lived out. And so if we want to get the benefit from the book of Proverbs, it's going to take time and reflection and practice, working it out in our daily lives. We need to sit down at the end of each bit and really think, well, what difference is this going to make for my life? But we also need to say that this isn't just a self-help book. This isn't just a book about getting rich quick, your path to happiness. There's plenty of worldly wisdom that will guide you into that, but that is morally dubious. How to cheat on your tax returns, how to cheat in an exam. But Proverbs has a moral dimension to it as well. It is for doing what is right and just and fair. Proverbs has a bigger goal than just my individual prosperity. It's to help us to live well together as a society. And that's going to be quite jarring in 2020. Our culture tends to prize the rights of the individual at the expense of family and society. Just think of the amount of films that you've seen where the young couple gets married against the advice of family and of society, and how that's applauded and celebrated. But Proverbs says again and again, you're not just an individual unit. You're connected to those around you. And whilst it might be tempting to cheat on the tax return, that's going to hurt the people around you, and that's going to hurt you as well. But I think the reason why I find Proverbs just so exciting and a little bit daunting is because it is so gritty and down to earth. It gives us no place to hide. It will challenge us on how we behave at work and why. How to have a conversation. What do you really value in life? How to deal with fools. And that's partly what makes it so scary. I can understand why we want to separate out Christianity on Sunday from the rest of the week. Because, of course, it's easier to be a Christian for 2 hours than it is to be a Christian for 168 hours in the week. But Proverbs won't let us do that. Every facet of life has religious dimensions. As boring as we might find our days, God is interested and he wants it to go well. He wants us to honour him in the way that we get up in the morning, in the way that we deal with frustrating people. I've been fascinated to see a new book that's come out recently that tries to recognise it. It's called Every Moment Holy, and it tries to give little liturgies or prayers really for daily life and daily moments. A prayer to say as you're doing the laundry. A prayer to say as you're doing your DIY. For a moment of frustration at a child. For when you have a sick day from work. I've yet to get it, so I can't fully endorse it. But I wholeheartedly applaud the sentiment that tries to break down this barrier between being a Christian on Sunday and the rest of the week as well. My life on Monday. But pushing on then. Who is this book for? In verse 4 it says, it's for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. It's for the simple and for the young. Now by simple, it doesn't mean those who are slow on the uptake, those who aren't very bright. All it means by someone who's simple is someone that's still young, someone that's a little bit green, that the cement hasn't quite set yet. They're still learning the ways that the world works. It brings to mind a teenager, really. Lucy was telling me a few months ago of someone who'd started her cafe, a young teenager. It was her first job, and she just didn't quite know the way that the world worked yet. She had unrealistic expectations of what that job would look like, of how she could behave in it, and particularly how to relate to older members of staff. Proverbs has that sort of person in mind, those who still have much to learn. It's to give them shrewdness. But before you think, well, I'm no spring chicken, I can just put it down. In verse 5, it says, let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. This is a book for parents as much as it is for children. It's as much a book for teachers as it is for their students. See, we never graduate from the book of Proverbs. Even if we're wise, we need to add to that wisdom. The discerning still need guidance. And there's a measure of grace in that. The wise person is not a finished product. God realizes that we're not perfectly wise already, and we still need help to walk along that path. If we feel unwise and in need of learning, well, that's a very good place to be. I think it was Socrates that said that the only true wisdom is knowing that you know nothing. I think that's getting close to this idea, the idea of the wise person being the teachable person. In verse 3, Proverbs, it is for those who will receive instruction in prudent behaviour. That word for instruction carries the idea of a chastening rebuke. The reader must accept the instruction and be willing to learn. In verse 6, it's for those who work hard at it. The Proverbs and the riddles of the wise, they take some chewing over, some thinking, some working out. It's been wisely said that the only place where success comes before work is in the dictionary. Who is Proverbs for? Well, it's for those who are teachable. It's for those who are willing to apply themselves to learning. The contrast is in verse 7. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fool is simply the one who will not learn, or the one who has stopped learning. So the challenge at the start of the book is, are we ready to learn? I found that gets harder and harder the older I get. It gets harder to have the humility that keeps on learning from God's word, the Bible. All too easy to think, well, I heard a sermon on that years ago, so I've got that one mastered now. It's a real spiritual discipline to stay teachable, to keep humbling ourselves before God's word and listening to him. But neither silver nor wisdom are mined in a day. We need to be in this one for the long haul, lifelong learners, whether we're 18 or 80. Proverbs calls us back into the classroom. The bell has rung. Break time is over. Verse 7 says that it is only the fool that doesn't answer that call, that doesn't bother to take their seat. So as we shuffle back into the classroom, as we wait for all the scraping and noise to quiet down, as we wait for the desktops to go down, Solomon gives us our first lesson. Where do we begin with this wisdom? Well, we begin in verse 7 with the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And by beginning there, it really does mean beginning, the very first thing. What the alphabet is to writing, what musical notes are to playing an instrument. The fear of the Lord is to wisdom and knowledge. It's the essential grammar of wisdom. If you've not got this, then you're not going to get anything else either. Which, when we think about it, is a huge claim. It's saying the only way to live a wise life is if you fear Yahweh. If you fear the God of the Bible, if you've not got that, then you're going to make a mess of life. You're playing the wrong notes in the wrong order. It's a huge claim. And in many ways, we'll see that Proverbs is there to confront and to challenge the wisdom of the world to say, no, stop, you've really got it the wrong way around there. But what do we mean by the fear of the Lord? I've heard, and perhaps given a few too many talks, which caveat this straight away and say, well, fear doesn't mean terror, it just means respect, really, like we might respect a father. And there's some wisdom to that, but for myself, I know that I presume on God far too much. All too often I'll go through half a day without prayer. I assume that God will forgive me, and so I plough on with sin. I treat God like an old mate rather than a holy God. But that's not the God of the Bible. The Bible is crystal clear that God is a God to be feared, a God that burns with holy purity. His power is beyond our ability to measure. We just don't know how big the universe is, and yet he measures it with the span of his hand. His ways are so deep and so inscrutable that we'll spend eternity delighting in him and never getting bored. Those who have visions of God are frequently flawed. They count themselves as good as dead. God is a God who should be feared. He's to be feared, perhaps like we might fear a cliff. I love cliffs, and some of my favourite places on this planet are cliff tops. The gorgeous sunshine, the way that the sea and the sky just blend off into the distance, and the sound of waves crashing against rocks at the bottom. It's truly awesome. But I can still remember as a child one day walking up to the edge of a cliff and looking over and being gripped with terror. Just wanting to hug the ground and be safe around it. I wouldn't dare to play around near the edge of a cliff. And that's where we ought to be with God. We ought to be stood before him with awe, but also fear. A fear that takes God's presence with the uttermost seriousness and reverence. We're not going to play around with it. The beginning of knowledge, the beginning of wisdom, is to have that perspective. Because God has set his world up to work in a certain way. Woe betide if we go against it. He's established certain laws of life, certain ways that the world and relationships will work, just as he's established certain laws of physics, gravity, and the rest. And the wise person lives in line with those laws. They cut along with the grain. They go with the flow of the current. Of course, you're free to ignore them. You're free to cut against the grain, free to push against that current, just as you're free to jump out of a plane without a parachute, ignoring those laws. But Solomon says that if you do, you'll pay the consequences. You'll be pushing against the God of the universe. That's why a right fear of the Lord is fundamental to being wise. It's to live in God's world, God's way. So the question for ourselves is how well do we know our ABC? I think if we look at our country, it's pretty well clear that we've forgotten the alphabet. When faced with World War II, our nation was called to a national day of prayer in the firm belief that God was bigger than us and that God was bigger than our problem. And now we're faced with an international pandemic. And our nation's faith isn't in God, it's in science. And whilst they're working as hard as they can, it's no wonder we're scared. Because in the grand scheme of things, we're very small and very frail. Science is still limited. We might be scared because we've forgotten who is in charge. I had a wonderful phone call the other week with an older member of the congregation who was saying that she's quite happy in isolation. She's not afraid because she can't die before God says so. Each one of her days is written in his book. Now that's a wonderful application of the fear of the Lord that trusts he is in control and in his hands we're perfectly safe. But even much of what calls itself Christianity doesn't live in a right fear of the Lord. I sometimes worry that we've domesticated God, that we give the impression that we can disagree with God and get away with it, that he doesn't really care how we treat others, and he never have the temerity to tell us how to live, that God is kind of cuddly and welcoming like a little kitten. I wonder how well we match up to the early church. In Acts, the early church is repeatedly described as living in the fear of the Lord. They worked out their salvation with fear and trembling. Paul urges the Corinthians, "Since we have these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves of every defilement of body and spirit, bringing holiness to completion in the fear of God. Just because we're in the New Testament doesn't mean that we suddenly stop fearing the Lord. God is the same today as he was then. And I know in Christ we can draw near, but a right fear of the Lord should only add to our astonishment that we can, through Christ, draw near to this God, the God who is awesome and terrifying in many ways. But as we close, the real punch of this passage is, are you going to buy this book? You've read the blurb. Are you ready now to come and listen? How far will you go to read it? The example of that we're given in the Bible is the Queen of Sheba. In Luke chapter 11, Jesus is speaking to a crowd and he says something astonishing. He says, the Queen of the South, that's the Queen of Sheba who we met earlier, will rise at the judgment and the people of this generation and will condemn them. She will be stood there saying, you fool. Why? Because she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom. And now someone greater than Solomon is here. That tells us two things. Firstly, how far we should go to get wisdom. We suspect that the Queen of Sheba was the queen in maybe Yemen. How far did she have to travel to get it? Well, approximately 1,268.9 miles to get to Jerusalem. We ought to be willing to travel that far. But the good news is that we don't have to. We have Solomon's wisdom right here in front of us. Because it's right there in front of you. Only a fool neglects to read it. Only a fool neglects to live by it. How happy are those who continually stand in front of this wisdom? But it also tells us where we need to go for our wisdom. We don't just go to Solomon, but to Jesus. Someone greater than Solomon is here. Jesus' wisdom stretches beyond that even given to Solomon. If we wanted to listen to Solomon and sit in his masterclass, well, how much more should we want to listen to Jesus? And to sit at his feet. He is the wise one who guides us not just into a life-filled life now, but a life-filled life in eternity.